Good afternoon and or good morning, whichever time zone you prefer to listen to us in. Welcome to the Substation Podcast. My name is Tom Edwards.
And my name is Emma Burns.
And we're going to talk about an exciting part of the electricity industry, demand, but specifically the reduction in demand. Because this winter is looking, how shall I put this? Scary? Is that? Would you agree, Emma? You're nodding.
Hairy. Scary.
Hairy.
Yeah.
We thought it would be timely to talk about the idea of demand and demand reduction or demand side response. Have we got a term for this? Is there like an overarching title?
The general term here is demand reduction in electricity. There are a number of different things that that can be. So I think in this episode, we will separate those things out, define what they are and talk about why they're different, why they're good. How do you bring them about?
There could be all sorts of different types of demand reduction, right? There's people talk about demand side response. They talk about demand flexibility. They talk about trips. They talk about rationing. They talk about demand destruction. And we want to get to the bottom of that, don't we?
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned, especially ahead of this winter, it's very important. But in general, it's just very important. The cleanest megawatt is the megawatt you don't consume. Or another quote I've heard recently is, if you reduce peak energy consumption by 5%, you save 50% of the costs. That was from a study based on the Californian energy crisis, which may have had specific attributes that aren't applicable to all markets and all circumstances. But nonetheless, I think it is often the peak, you know, the marginal generator.
Because that's the plan, right? Is you can't, because it is difficult to store electricity effectively. You have to plan your network to meet the peak load, what you think is going to be used most at the same time for your system, because at some point that's what your system will have to do. I think it's also probably worth noting that the Substation Podcast does not know if there will be any sort of demand reduction or rationing or fuel security code events this winter. This is not a prediction or a forecast. We just think that, I guess, on the available evidence at this stage, it looks like in the case of a cold and still day or run of days, things might get quote-unquote hairy.
And, I mean, this is an interesting and important topic regardless of what's happening this winter as well.
Exactly, because DSR is often spoken about in market design, and if you look back to things like the better design documents, the British Electricity Trading and Transmission Arrangements, one of the things they wanted to do is to make sure that the demand side was capable of participating. And one of the accusations they levelled at the pool design was that demand had very little to do, and therefore there was no demand side response. And demand side response is the cheapest and cleanest form of peak energy provision. Like, if you don't have to provide that peak megawatt, as you said, it's like the cheapest, it's the cleanest thing to do. And it's always the ambition of whoever's designing a market that demand side response turns up and saves us all this money. And we've been talking about it. There's even National Grid ESO have a specific demand side response forum specifically for it. Lots of people talk about it. They really want it to be there. You know, it's clear that all the academic stuff says that this is the best way to, or one of the best ways, part of the solution. If you don't have this as part of your mix, your system is more expensive than it needs to be. But in practice, it just doesn't work, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's been a bit of a panacea for the market, really. And it hasn't happened, or at least it has to some degree, but not as much as we would like, or maybe would have expected 20 years ago when we were doing the market design.
Yeah. Fundamentally, you don't see demand participating on the same playing field as generation. It's not in the balancing mechanism, kind of offering its flexibility to the system operator, to the extent that it's mostly a passive price taker in the wholesale markets. It is in ancillary services, but it's difficult to tell if that is a generator behind the demand meter or if it's genuine demand side response. And in most cases, genuine demand side response is dwarfed by the amount of just behind the meter generation there is. So I think it's very difficult to do. It appears to be very difficult to do to scale, and we honestly haven't been that successful against the criteria that I think people may have had when they started out on this journey. Not that they haven't been successful. I think that, you know, there's more than there was. It's just that the scale of it is dwarfed.
So what do we mean by demand reduction? What different kinds of demand reduction or categories are we talking about here?
We narrowed it down to what we reckon are four types of demand reduction. So energy efficiency, doing the same thing I'm doing but more efficiently and therefore using less energy.
So the classic example there is new light bulbs that use less energy.
Or insulating your home, for a gas example, I suppose. The other one then is dispatchable demand reduction or demand side response. So this would be changing the way you use electricity, either by time or by volume in response to a signal. Then we would have demand destruction or self-rationing. So this is an overall reduction in energy usage, but generally a involuntary response. So something like, I cannot afford my energy bills and therefore I will use less energy, or I will go out of business and therefore the demand has been destroyed. And the last one is rationing or centrally enforced rationing. So this would be where there is some form of centralized control over demand or over the way demand is supplied, so that the network is reconfigured so people don't have access to energy and only certain parties do.
So broadly, the first two there are kind of, they're voluntary, they're generally in response to an incentive of some kind, so energy efficiency and DSR, demand side response, whereas the second two are involuntary, the demand destruction and energy rationing. They're not a choice.
Yeah, so energy efficiency, demand side response, I get a signal of some kind. So the examples here would be the wholesale market. If the price of power in a certain time is above some, I don't know, internal metric, I could decide not to use that energy at that time. And if I have the option, crucially, if I have the option to be flexible with that demand, if I can measure it, if I understand it, if I can use that asset in a way that can be measured and understood, and there's a price signal that's appropriate, I can take that action either by changing the way that process is done, so I can use a new piece of equipment, or I can change the time it's used at or the way it's used. So one of those would be energy efficiency, the other one would be demand-side response. And another example would be an ancillary service. So National Grid says, I'm willing to pay anyone who can provide a megawatt. And a megawatt here we can define as either an increase in generation or reduction in consumption. So National Grid says, I'm willing to pay anyone who can provide a megawatt between these times, this much money. You could, you know, if you can measure it, and you can operationalize it, then most ancillary services contracts will accept a reduction in demand. Those should be dispatchable, controllable. They importantly need to be measurable and operationable. So they need to be the communications and settlement systems and all that sort of stuff. Whereas demand destruction, self-rationing, we are overall reducing the amount of energy that's being used by not carrying out activities. So the examples here are probably the most fresh in everyone's minds, because this is my business cannot afford the bills, or I don't think I can afford the heating bill or lighting bill, and so therefore I will self-ration. And in the case of businesses, you might become insolvent or stop that activity. So change focus of your business or literally just go out of business. And that demand is now gone. The main difference here to the centrally enforced rationing is that this is some form of centralized body, either be it the government through, at the moment it would have to be through the Fuel Security Code and the Electricity Security Emergency Security Supply Code, ESEC.
And the Emergency Executive Committee? Nope. The Emergency, the 3EE.
Yeah, 3EC.
What is it again?
Energy Emergency Executive.
Yes, very nice.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so those would be the government kind of responses. They would say, okay, I mean, I guess because I'm English, I'm going to use a war metaphor. In the Second World War, rationing was introduced because there was not enough stuff to carry out essential war activities and for everyone to do what they wanted. So decision was taken that you can only do certain things in order to make sure that there was enough stuff, food, energy, whatever. In this case, energy. So the idea here would be, okay, 3-day week for businesses. You can't turn your factory on from Thursday to Friday because we need to save energy. The other example here is that, you know, certain households or certain areas will only receive energy, but the network will be reconfigured so that energy only flows to certain areas at certain times. Everyone will be given a notice of these are the times in which you will have energy. These are the times in which you will not have energy. And this allows energy to be directed to where it is most useful so that, you know, certain households have energy at certain times and certain businesses, such as the ones that provide us with, say, air traffic control, nuclear waste management, or food production, have energy all the time that they need it. So, yeah, that kind of thing is called rotor disconnection. So that will be under your kind of fuel security code or energy security emergency code. But you could also see it under the operational code in the grid code. So, for example, where the system operator foresees with enough foresight that there will be a low margin event, so that, let's, for example, take what could happen this winter, which is it's very cold. We have a 1 in 10 year cold winter day. So we know it's going to be dark. We know it's going to be cold. Lots of people are running their heating. The gas is running flat out. Therefore, the wind isn't blowing as well because it's still. France needs a lot of energy from us because they don't have enough power to provide for their heating, which is very electrically focused. So the decision is taken looking 4 hours ahead, for example. There isn't enough power on the margin. There isn't enough that will ever come on. Can't convince the French to turn the interconnector the other way around. So National Grid might phone up the DNOs and say, look, we might ask you to do some rotor disconnections. Be available, be ready.
Well, there's two options there, isn't there? There's blackouts and brownouts.
Yes.
So there's demand disconnection, so I'm cutting you off. Yeah. Or there's voltage reduction, so I'm just going to reduce the voltage temporarily, which should both have the same effect of reducing demand, albeit probably at different amounts.
Yeah, and it will depend on exactly what the event is that they're needing to meet. So if there's enough foresight and they know it's going to happen, they can ask for it in advance. The other more likely event is that they try everything they can. So they warm up the coal, they try and buy in as much power as they can from the continent, from Ireland, from wherever.
They send loads of warnings to the markets. There's capacity market notices. There's energy margin notices.
E-min
will come first. Twitter is going mad. Yeah. Yeah.
you get your E-min first, your electricity margin notification. Then you get your HRDR, which is your high risk of demand reduction. So that's at the start of the, when the gate closes, HRDR comes on and goes, okay, there's a high risk in this period that there isn't going to be enough capacity to meet demand. That's basically telling to you that in the next hour and a half, things might get bad. Then you have your demand control imminent, which is the start of the settlement period, anytime in the next 30 minutes. They could trip that threshold and cause there to be. And so basically when the frequency hits those thresholds, your automatic trips will kick in. So if there just wasn't enough capacity to meet demand, the frequency would fall the automatic low frequency demand disconnection relays would kick in, severing 5% of demand. So that would be if the frequency fell because of this event, that's when your low frequency demand disconnection relays will kick in. Grid might have asked the DNOs to do something before then so that that doesn't occur. So they then might say, okay, what can you give us? We need, you know, there's a 500 megawatt shortfall. Can you give us a gigawatt? They'll ask all of the DNOs. They'll find that either by shutting off parts of their network or by reducing the voltage. So, yeah, that's kind of the centrally enforced idea, is that, you know, you're taking a decision to not do something in order to do something else.
And that's what is above all, well, almost above all, that we want to avoid. I suppose what demand control is used to avoid is a total system blackout, which is a whole different kettle of fish in terms of getting the system back started again and customers back being provided energy.
Yeah, so that's where your automatic systems are kicking in to to basically prevent going through a black start, which is the worst of all possible worlds. But your rationing could kick in before that, because in that case, you know, the government might have taken the decision that, look, for example, a huge storm sweeps the Atlantic clear and no boats are making it, you know, no LNG tankers are making it for the next 2 weeks. It's cold, it's still, there's no chance we'll make it through the next week without a boat arriving. So the government takes the decision to say, look, we have to ration energy because of this event, which I'm not a meteorologist, I don't know how likely that would be. You know, that you could see that kind of situation. Or, for example, one of the LNG terminals broke down, or both of them broke down at the same time. Incredibly unlikely event. Both of the LNG terminals break down. We can't bring any more gas into the system. That's the situation you might find yourself in. We are trying to avoid blackouts. That's the ultimate event that would happen. But in that case, it literally isn't enough energy left.
And so all these other things that we've talked about in terms of reducing demand, we would want to come before that. So we want energy efficiency, I suppose, across the board, so that we have an overall lower peak. We're using overall energy. We want to be able to use flexible demand, so demand side response.
Not to mention an efficient economy is a productive economy. We'll create more wealth by spending less money on energy.
Yes. And then we want demand-side response, so flexible demand, to be able to shift, respond when needed the most to, you know, shave off those peaks. We don't want demand destruction or self-rationing. I think both of those things are things, if you have the first two pieces right, and obviously a lot of other pieces in terms of the overall system, we would ideally like to avoid. So should we dive into each of these in a bit more detail? Our experience with them, how they're generally incentivized?
Yes. So for a lot of these, the this one holds true. The idea is that the price of the energy should dictate the action. So we should see that, you know, it's very obvious to us now, seeing where prices are at the moment, to say that using less energy is a good idea. But the theory goes is that if the price of power or gas is high, we should seek to use less of it, because there would be a return to us doing so if we can still maintain the same level of output. In practice, it's difficult to get people to invest in energy efficiency on their own.
And these are longer term investments needed, right? I mean, you need to be able to make the investment 6 months, a year ahead of when the high prices are for it to take effect. You know, if it's replacing your light bulbs or insulating your house, these things take time. It's not just a simple case of turning off your oven at peak times.
So the simple answer here for why we don't see much of it is that these are often capital intensive. You know, there's a large upfront cost that doesn't necessarily, in normal times, pay back very quickly.
Capital intensive, but also highly decentralized. Britain is very good at doing capital intensive, large projects. It's easy for the government to sign off on a new nuclear. I mean, granted, it hasn't been built and it's slightly stalled, but, you know, it's easy for the government to sign off on large scale power stations.
Yeah, I mean, these are small. So let's take it down to the household level, for example. When I say capital intensive, I guess over the whole nation, yes, it's going to be lots and lots of money. But even for a household, you're talking about spending a couple of thousand. So double glazing, you're talking £2,000 or £3,000 to do all of your building. And you, even at today's prices, you might only see a couple of £100 of saving. And you're entirely right here, is that that's actually quite a big outlay for an individual household. So you've got to multiply that by 29 million buildings, right? So it's highly decentralized. You've got to get people to take that decision on their own, in their own house, get people in to be disruptive to their lifestyle, perhaps even change their behavior in some ways, depending on what they install. So yeah, you're not just talking about whacking a new cable across the seabed or building a new power station. It's a distributed event.
Well, that's the thing. And I think there's a cost element to that. So you're relying on each of those individual households to have sufficient capital to make that investment. But there's also almost like a complexity and administrative element. Like if you're building a big cable under the sea, you know, there's usually only one or two companies that own it, you know, that you're dealing with those directly. Maybe you're developing a subsidy bespoke for them or for their kind of project. That feels easier almost conceptually and administratively than dealing with 26 million households and, you know, supporting them all individually with their bespoke needs and their bespoke.
So that's the challenge around designing a scheme outside of the energy market, because that, you know, ideally we just want people to do this in response to their bills. But as we said, it's very capital intensive. You might not see payback for many, many years, after which case perhaps you've moved out of your house or you've just forgotten about the thing that you did. You may never actually experience yourself the upside, or you might not ever actually, even though you actually do, you know, after 10, 12 years, actually do get the benefit of it. You've forgotten, right, that I did that thing. So you have to have some kind of scheme, because the wholesale market isn't encouraging this. So what kind of subsidy do you design that is both capable of measuring this and then rewarding that? And how do you spread that out to 29 million companies? Well, you know, not companies, buildings. Well, you don't. You probably target another party. Do you target the supplier? So the person who has a relationship with every household in the country. Or do you target an installer? So somebody who's actually in the business of putting this kit in. Do you target the bank and, you know, the person providing a mortgage and say, you know what, we can underwrite loans that are going on home energy efficiency improvements, because, you know, most people have a relationship with a bank of some kind. So yeah, you've got to work out who you're targeting. It's going to be practically impossible to target individual households. So which party in the market are you targeting, and which one's best? So for example, the ECO, the energy company obligation, was an obligation on suppliers to put in energy efficiency improvements, and they had to talk to registered installers, and they had to target to install a certain amount of stuff. So this, people may remember, at some point suppliers were going out and offering light bulbs, energy efficient light bulbs, and that was part of their ECO obligations. That was expensive. And I think that was the thing that David Cameron said, let's get rid of the green crap, which we might bleep out, I'm not sure. And I mean, looking back in hindsight, probably not the best decision. But
what else went wrong here? Because it wasn't just the expense of it, right? I mean, as I understand it, maybe suppliers didn't fulfill their obligations.
So there were things like just offering free light bulbs to people, whether or not they put them in, were one of those things. But then there was also
tokenism, almost.
Yeah, it was a level of kind of, it was one of the bigger parts of the bill. So it was expensive because it was doing a lot of stuff. It was starting to wind up in kind of scale and intensity. So by this point, there was quite a lot going on. So you could point to it on the bill and go, oh, that's an easy target to point at. Kind of famous for not succeeding is the Green Deal. So this is where you would kind of take out a loan from the government and you'd use the savings to pay back that loan over time. And you could invest it in things like insulation, heating, draft proofing.
Is this the one that was called the middle class subsidy?
Yeah, because it was a loan. And it was for basically, you only really benefited if you're a homeowner as well. You could get some money to invest in something you probably could have afforded anyway in most of those cases. Its uptake wasn't brilliant.
So we had ECO, which targeted suppliers, tried to get to customers through suppliers, and the Green Deal tried to get to customers directly, so they would have the loan directly.
You had to go with a Green Deal provider, I think, as well, like an accredited installer.
What other options are there? What have we not tried?
So I guess there are direct investments by the government, for example. You could just say, look, we're gonna give everyone on the street £10,000 to install heating, and the government takes out a loan to do this because, well, the government can print money, so what? And it saves UK PLC and reduces overall gas use. It's a cheaper way of meeting your carbon objectives than building a new power station. So you could have that kind of direct intervention. The other party that you could talk to would be your DNO. So you could have the distribution network operator come in and saying, by the way, have you considered having this put in, doing that, and getting them to target the customer? Because back in the day, customers got their energy from their regional board. So perhaps, and those companies would sell appliances and things like that. So perhaps you could have, you could go back to having regional supply boards that offer people deals on efficient appliances.
More longer term, there's also housing standards. So requiring any new build houses to meet certain standards around energy efficiency, insulation, yeah. which already exist, but I suppose they could go further. And then also, I guess, looking at things like microgeneration, EV charging. The quote that I've heard is that getting energy efficiency correct in domestic housing could achieve a 20% overall cut in emissions, which, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to get anything done in domestic premises because you're up against the... So first up, you're up against the pricing incentives. So it's generally, for most consumers, a flat price and standing charges. So I don't really see that much of an incentive to reduce my demand at peak. It doesn't matter if I use my demand when I use my demand. So I might as well use it when I want to. Then you're running up against the classic thing of habits. How do you change people's habits? Because, you know, some energy efficiency changes will need changes in habits. Because a lot of these things, are especially around peak demand, are essential activities. So people need dinner, need light to see. I've got to watch my TV because I'm tired. Got to record my podcast. Oh, and I guess the other thing is accurately measuring that. How do you know you've got the response that you would have got? Because not only are you dealing with the inaccuracy of non-half hourly metering, in most cases, until the half hourly rollout is complete, you're also dealing with the difficulty of additionality. Because to what extent have I got something that I would have got anyway because of natural behavior change, or just if prices were increasing, maybe consumers would have done this anyway.
So then coming on to demand side response. So here we're talking about dispatchable demand reduction. So it could be in response to a price, it could be in response to a signal. But the point here is that it's flexible demand that can either shift its consumption to a different period, or even, you know, not consume the same energy. It can forego that. And it's a source of flexibility. So it's, you know, competing with battery storage, with gas-fired generation to provide system services, to provide real-time energy.
What kind of signals? So we've mentioned price, but what other kinds of signals would a demand-side response or flexible demand look for or be exposed to?
Price is probably the most straightforward, whereby if a customer is exposed to prices, they might see the price is too high, I do not want to pay it. I suppose, alternatively, a DSR provider could be signed up to a balancing service or ancillary service with the electricity system operator and contractually obliged to respond in a certain way. That could be a sort of intentional, that could be, yeah, an intentional response, or you could allow some of your assets to be remotely controlled. So you could have an aggregator turning things on and off at certain times. So I think the good example of that would be an electric vehicle. So you can, if it's plugged in overnight, you could have the EV not charging at certain times or stopping charging, or even, you know, with vehicle to grid, you could have them exporting back onto the system. And the customer itself might be totally unaware of all this happening in the moment. It just happens automatically.
There's lots of markets where demand-side response already is. What's the biggest market for demand-side response at the moment?
Are we talking about, we're talking about true demand-side response? Because this comes back to the point that you made earlier of... Because that's the thing, there's sort of true demand-side response where less energy is being consumed, or there's, I don't want to say fake demand-side response, but...
Behind-the-meter generation.
Behind-the-meter generation, exactly, where you have a backup generator that is providing your energy, so you're not taking it from the system. So what do you mean?
Well, I think the answer might be the same either way. So I'm going to say true demand-side response.
In that case, I'm going to say the wholesale market.
Okay. I was going to say the capacity market.
But that's not response. We could get in, let's not get into weeds
we could get into that, but I mean, there's probably more meters signed up to that service that we know are true demand side response than anything else.
And we can't really measure what's really going on in the wholesale market as well. We can't see those contracts. We can't see those actions. So we both win.
Yeah, I mean, so you've also got network charges as well, because Triads is the other one that people point to, and that Grid says that there's something between, was it 2.5 to 4 gigawatts of extra demand that they see come April, March? March, because that's when the Triad season ends. I've only been doing this for 11 years.
Or similarly, distribution network charges, so distribution use of system charges. So different DNOs will have things such as red, amber, green rates, where during a certain time, there will be a red rate, which means that it is much more expensive to consume during that time. So you'll see a lot of demand side response avoiding those periods.
Yeah, and there's very little demand. There is demand side response in things like store. I don't know if there's any of the dynamic services, but I think there is an FFR, but it's not huge. It's probably like 50 megawatts or something. Yeah, that was my reason for saying the capacity market, because I could at least point to a number and say that's a qualified meter. Whether or not it's actually physically capable of doing that, well, it has to prove it is at least 3 times a year.
Why? Okay, so demand side response is particularly valuable because it is, as we said, an alternative source of flexibility, so it can respond quickly. You know, it's not like energy efficiency where there's a long lead time to reduce the energy demand. You can't see it. You can't call upon it. It's there when you need it, demand side response. So it helps with that peak shaving point. It helps reduce carbon emissions.
So that follows then that things like half hourly metering and communications architecture are very important, so that signal can be passed either from the wholesale market through to typically the supplier or the aggregator, then onto the consumer, or from the ESO to the aggregator or supplier onto the consumer. So and back, you know, the data can flow back and forth. That's one of the key things. One of my challenges on that, though, is that in the past, ESOs complained about demand side response being slow. So that, or uncertain. So I think it was the SBR, the DSBR, the demand side
balancing.
Yeah, because they were, when those contracts were signed, they complained that actually the amount of time it took to schedule the demand side response was so slow that it wasn't worth using.
I'd say I think that depends. So this winter, we have a new demand side response service targeting domestic and INC DSR. So effectively new kinds of DSR that haven't participated in other services. But the intention is to be almost as inclusive as possible. So that service is based on, will be based on a day ahead signal. So it's based on a trial that was run by Octopus, energy supplier, whereby they would email customers at the day ahead stage and say, hey, you, reduce your energy tomorrow at 5 p.m. Maybe exact words, maybe different.
And you'll get paid.
And you'll get paid, exactly. So be aware, do it tomorrow. So it's very much, you know, customers need that. If you're actually relying on domestic customers in particular to go around and turn off lights, ovens, TVs, unnecessary energy demand at a certain time, then they need warning. They need to have that foresight. However, the flip side of that, I suppose, the more advanced demand side response, where you have aggregators who have access to assets and can remotely control them, that can happen basically instantaneously. That can compete perfectly with other kinds of flexibility.
So what kind of asset is that?
It can be any number of different assets. So you can turn off fridges in supermarkets or lighting or electric vehicles, you can stop them from charging.
So it might be that, say, in an Amazon distribution center in an unused car park that's lit at, you know, peak times, they might turn the lights off because aggregator has got access to them and Amazon has said it's okay, we're not using that parking lot at the moment, no one's in there working, so you can turn the lights off when you want in response to an ESO signal.
Exactly. Commercial processes that don't necessarily need to happen.
Pumps, I'd imagine, being quite good.
Water. There's, you know, a great amount of flexibility in those processes in terms of you don't necessarily need to pump right now for everything. You can pump in an hour.
Yeah. Fridges are always mentioned, aren't they? Because basically they come with storage inbuilt, aren't they? That, you know, they're already insulated. The cold will stay in there. If you miss them out for half an hour, they'll still be cold as long as you turn them back on again. What's the other thing I find fascinating about demand side response is the idea of a baseline. Because when you call on a, again, this is going back to that additionality question, is like, what am I actually measuring against? Because once you've reduced the demand, I don't know what I'm measuring from. So what actual response have I got? Because I asked, you know, this, the baseline comes in is that I don't know what you were actually going to do. You did something different. What are we actually measuring from? So the baseline is basically saying, okay, normally at this time of day, I'm consuming 100 units, but you asked me to reduce by 50 units. And here I can show you I was only using 50 units. But if I was using 45, have I actually given you 55 units? Or would I actually have only used 95 units and I still gave you the 50? And that's important from the settlement and, you know, who gets paid what perspective.
It's definitely a tricky part. It's important in terms of, as you said, settlement, also in terms of knowing how much you're going to get. So, you know, if it's the system operator, it wants to know that it is going to receive a certain amount of response when it issues an instruction. And it's also important for gaming. So, for example, if you were to say your baseline is what you did yesterday, then if I knew an event was coming, maybe the day before I could artificially increase my demand so that I get paid more the following day. So it's the baselining methodologies for demand side response are very central or very important to try and, I mean, they're very important to
set an accurate baseline.
Exactly.
A event can be measured.
And to ensure trust in the service as well, to know that we're getting what we asked for.
Yeah, it's important for everyone, not just
yes.
the receiver of the service, the system operator or the trader, but also for the provider so that they can have foresight of what they're going to get paid. So what's the typical, isn't it like a 4 in 5? Like you look back at the last 4-5 events over the previous 4 periods or something like that is one of the...
What's being used for this new national grid service and what is being introduced in the wholesale market in Britain is 10 in 60. So looking at the 10 similar days from the last 60 days and using that. So the 10 most recent days from the last 60 days. So say if it's a Monday, you know, you look at maybe...
the last 10 Mondays.
Yeah, or 10 working days probably at the same time when you weren't delivering the service as well. We've mentioned how we incentivize it. We've talked about the wholesale market, balancing services, capacity market. Why do you think we haven't seen more of it?
So I think my big 3 things would be, from a control point of view, the ESO has historically gone or felt they can't trust demand response and so have preferred generation. Big spinning things, which is changing, but probably not as quickly as some people would like. The other one is that it hasn't been worth doing things like demand response. It's cost a lot to get into the game. It costs a lot to put in the equipment. So first of all, you need an accurate enough meter. So then you need the control equipment. Then you need the contractual framework and a business that can talk to all the relevant parties and settle things out. So all of those things are not cheap. And you get what? If the price, you know, if back when power was, what, £50 a megawatt hour and maybe peak power was 100, 150, great, a couple of times a year I'm getting £100 a megawatt hour and I've had to shuffle some stuff around and maybe make my customers' experience or my staff's experience less good. That's obviously, so the key things there are, you know, making the measurement easier, maybe allowing cheaper types of meters that don't have to be as accurate. Communications, like there's no need for all the, historically all grid comms has had to go through centralized lines that had to be certain levels of secure. Now we can have access to cheaper over the internet communications architecture. That could be a better way in. And just the way suppliers work has always been a nightmare to try and fit in when you're not a supplier. So that's changing with things like P344, 415, P375, P376, some mods that I just listed off about improving demand-side response and measurement of demand-side response specifically.
But I've got two more, which related to what you've said. So the first one is around rules and regulations. So we've mentioned settlement before. Currently, as we know, a lot of demand customers in Britain, domestic, are still settled on the basis of profiles, so they're not exposed to their actual consumption in half hour by half hour, and as a result, neither are their suppliers. So that's a big thing, especially for that kind of price responsive, and also domestic demand side response. And then the fifth thing would be carbon pricing. I would argue the signal there hasn't been strong enough. Had it been stronger, we would have seen demand side response be more cost effective compared to gas wired flexibility. You disagree?
I do disagree slightly. So I think that you're right if you're talking about gas, because gas has no carbon, or domestic gas has no carbon price on it. So I think that we would have seen more response in gas if there had been a carbon price equivalent to the carbon price in electricity. I don't think, or given my experience, I don't think that we would be able to set a acceptable carbon price in the power market that would drive behaviour. I think the carbon price would have to be so high that you would get a kickback. It would be politically unachievable to put in a carbon price that would incentivize behaviour, because carbon prices are already like £120 a megawatt hour, and they're not doing. And even last winter they were still in total like £60 to £80 a megawatt hour and still weren't doing anything. So you're talking about £400-£500 carbon taxes that I just don't think you would ever get a government.
I think there's other ways to skin that cat. You could have maybe targeted demand or targeted carbon prices in balancing services.
I can see that argument. I can see you saying, well, perhaps grid has to pay more to lower carbon flexibility. So there's a carbon tax, or it's a reverse carbon or a carbon subsidy. So grid purchases all of the services it wants, but then anyone who can prove that they're 100% low carbon gets an additional £100 per megawatt on top.
So what about demand destruction or self-rationing? Why does that come about?
We were defining this as an involuntary response to high prices or a signal. So typically it's not something we want to incentivize.
Yeah, maybe the question is, how do we prevent this?
Yeah. The other question there is, we've run into a fundamental conflict in market design and here, because we want prices to signal behavior.
Uh-huh.
So if the price rises, you should use less or use a different thing, which is difficult to do in electricity. It's a homogeneous commodity. You don't really have much choice about where it comes from or who it comes from. And on the other hand, we want stable, controllable systems that allow the basis of well-planned activity. Those two kind of juxtapose, they don't really get on very well. And we do want to have sensible, rational markets where if there isn't enough of something, we have to work out a way to use less of it or use a different thing. But we also want our businesses to be stable and capable of planning for the future. So which one is it? Which one takes precedence? That's a political decision at this point in time. It's not something I don't think market design can inform at this point. The prices, all I can tell you about wholesale market prices right now is that they're screaming, don't use gas. There isn't a rational signal in there anymore. I can't see that the kind of peak GB price is related to the marginal cost of any particular generator on the system anymore. So all I can tell you is use less gas. And that's where we're getting into demand destruction, because we want to use less gas. The price is forcing businesses out of business, which will help us use less gas. But also then we won't have the businesses that we rely on to pay our taxes with or to provide people with wages and, the cornerstone. So that's where it becomes a political decision at this point, because who should and shouldn't be using the gas?
And again, I guess one solution to that is some sort of out of market, what do I mean, out of market subsidy or something.
Like furlough, business reliefs.
Exactly.
During the pandemic style response, big state stuff that comes in and makes the hard decisions.
But that's tough because you're kind of saying, well, consume your gas, keep running your business, but we'll give you this rebate back. But then you're completely removing any incentives for that demand side response.
Exactly.
Which we want.
Yeah, if you've got a business that's saying, okay, well, we're going to go out of business because we're going to close down over the winter, but actually we're just making widgets that aren't really used in anything, well, perhaps that business could close down for the winter and we wouldn't be that much worse off. So there's then an efficiency question here is which businesses get the support, because if we're just using that gas to make widgets that no one really needs, what if there's a business somewhere else that also needed support that made bread, for example, and you've got a question of where does that support go? Because ultimately the businesses you keep alive are the ones that are going to keep using energy, and we better hope that, you know, we have a problem with energy. Well, this isn't a market design question. The market has the answer, which is the price of gas is very, very high. Stop using gas. But we can't have that answer. If you're a government, that answer doesn't work, because then you're telling voters, taxpayers, citizens, please sit in the dark and cold and suffer, which is we don't want that answer. The market doesn't want that answer. The
humans don't want that answer. The market might. Yeah. We left to its own devices. That's what the market wants.
Yeah. The market is screaming, stop using gas.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's only so many tankers. The American, what is it, Freeport LNG burnt. It's ultimately the market has given us the answer, that it's now up to government, politicians, society to decide how best to cope with this situation. It is the limitation of a market that is not capable of answering these externalities.
How much to intervene, basically.
Yeah, and ultimately it's an essential commodity. We don't expect the market to run. I mean, so if you accept the analogy that this is maybe like a war, we don't expect markets to run armies. The market has given us the answer, and the answer is use less gas. That's not an acceptable answer in this situation, so something else has to be done.
So the last kind of form of demand reduction is this sort of centrally enforced response where you have either demand control or low frequency demand disconnection. And again, as we mentioned, this is kind of the second last resort before total system blackout. It's not a market driven mechanism. It's more driven by the need to keep the lights on.
For the majority of businesses or even the most important minority of businesses and consumers.
Well, keep the lights on for the majority.
Keep the system in a minimum viable state.
Yeah, exactly. But you're also, it's about timing as well, right? Like if you disconnect certain customers for an hour, you could prevent the whole country from being in the dark for 2 days.
Yeah, weeks, but sure.
And so all the things that we mentioned before are measures that should hopefully help prevent this, as is every other bit in the market, you know, capacity mechanisms, energy prices.
The current rationing plans already have that kind of planning into it. So there are significant supplies. So certain consumers have got priority over others in this situation. So for example, hospitals, airports, the traffic light network, important server farms, and some businesses have obligations, or some businesses and civil entities, so for example, hospitals, again, server farms, have obligations to have backup generators on site. Those backup generators even have carve-outs under emissions legislation, so that, these things don't get fired up very often. We don't care what nitrogen and sulfur dioxide and particulates they produce, because we're using them in an emergency. There's already prioritization, and then when you get down to kind of everyone who isn't prioritized, it's done in this kind of quote-unquote fair way, in that just, you know, sections of the network are partitioned off. Every postcode gets a plan of when they will and won't have energy, and it just goes cycles through that quote-unquote fair allocation. Yeah, we had to reread these bits very recently, because how often I dipped into Section G contingencies of the Balancing Settlement Code was not very often. Only occasionally when people kind of asked the question, what happens in this event, was the only reason I ever checked Section G. So can't honestly say I'm hugely familiar or have been hugely familiar with these sections until recently.
And then I suppose the final general point to make is that this was the most important thing of all, I think we can probably all agree, is consumer protection. And all of these demand reduction measures, whether they're voluntary or involuntary, need to have that at the heart of it. Yeah. So even where we're talking about demand side response or even energy efficiency, that needs to be done in a way that's fair, and it needs to be done alongside consumer protection. We don't want customers who aren't flexible to feel like they need to be flexible. You know, then that starts to look and feel like self-rationing. That's not what we want. We want those customers who can to respond, but, you know, the others not to. And I think it's really important to get the messaging right there at a government level, you know, across the board and in the press from National Grid. The message needs to be quite nuanced, I think, so that we can incentivize and encourage the right kind of demand-side response, but prevent the wrong kind.
Yeah, and it definitely feels like a tale of two halves as well. We've talked about the stuff that is flexible, useful, stuff we would like to see as business as usual part of the system. It would actually unlock huge amounts of savings just in even normal everyday system running, assuming that there's no crises at all is occurring. And then we've talked about, you know, the wrong stuff, the oh dear, things have gone wrong things. And in that situation, you know, we're kind of leaving the domain of the market and market design, and we're into the kind of civil society. This is how we want things to run for the good of the country, for the good of everyone living here. No matter where you live, who you are, everyone has a right to energy. Nobody should be sitting alone in the cold, in the dark. I think your point about messaging was very good, because you've seen the government, until very recently, they have been like, use the energy you need to use. If you need to use energy, use it.
Which is a broad message. I mean, if that message is going to, as was the masses, I think that is the right message, because you don't want vulnerable customers or customers who need that energy to misinterpret that message. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I.
If you're running a dialysis machine, run the dialysis machine.
Yes, exactly. You don't want that message to be misinterpreted. However, there's a message that needs to go alongside that, which is, again, nuanced and careful, that says, or, you know, there's an incentive.
If you've got your Christmas lights on in July, turn them
exactly
off.
Yeah, cop on. Like, or, you know, here's a new service, we'll pay you if you reduce, you know, get the carrot out. But don't threaten the stick.
Although it is worth noting that they've kind of recently started moving away from that and saying, you know, some form of energy response might be needed. But again, beyond the realm of market design and beyond the bit I feel comfortable talking about, weighty topic.
Yeah, I think there's more we will dig into here. I think I would like to get very in-depth into energy efficiency and demand-side response in particular.
Well, thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Tom.
You've been listening to the Substation Podcast. You can find us at Energy Burns on Twitter, at Notional Grid on Twitter. That's for Emma. The first one's for Emma, the second one's for Tom. You can also contact us on the at Substation Podcast on Twitter, or substationpodcast@gmail.com.